podcast with the real world meets the digital world as we explore the intersection of spatial computing and AI. Let's welcome our host, Andrew Ballard. Over to you, AB.
Well, g'day. Welcome to Spatial. This is episode 19, coming to you the last week of May, after a gap of 1 week. So it's been a fortnight since we had Mirik, who's here online. G'day, Mirik.
Hello. How's everybody doing?
Good, good. Yeah, we had a great reaction to your All About Roz, which has been good. A lot of podcast downloads. The YouTube channel is starting to bite a little bit, which is really good. We are definitely in the playpen of load numbers. So, hey, if you haven't checked out the YouTube series, it is what you are listening to now, but you can watch us. So, tell you what, we'll wave something that you can't see on the podcast. There you go. You also can't see Hubert in the background doing laps. He's the turtle, and you can't tell what Mirik is drinking at this moment. Look, welcome. This is a this is almost a news of the month kind of thing. There has absolutely been a trend that we've been watching. In fact, about 3 weeks ago, we were about to do an episode on this topic. We got pulled away. But in the last 3-4 weeks, this topic has just blown out of proportion. What is it? Well, you've probably read the title. This is the rise of really fast large language models, or really fast models. A question we'll ask sometime in this episode is, are they just language models? Are they also spatially aware general world models? Casting the clock back about 4 weeks, I'm actually looking back at Meta's announcement. So Meta, i.e. Facebook, late April, April 18th, they announced the release of Llama 3. Llama 3, open source language model and language only, doesn't do any multimodal, no images, no uploads, simply text. But the big thing there was that it was fast. If you played with any of the GPTs before, you're sort of used to typing in a request, and that tiny pause, the pregnant pause, the little pause where it goes and has a bit of a think and comes back with, yeah, a wall of text. And often the wall of text, you can kind of scroll and catch up with it. Well, literally 4 weeks ago with Llama 3, you couldn't do either of those things. The moment you hit enter, you pretty much got the wall of text and you couldn't scroll fast enough to keep up with it. What that meant was it suddenly opened up doors to, you could normally like outthink what you were doing with a large language model with the chat modes. Llama 3 was the first one really that made it quite astounding that the moment you asked it a large, deep question, it would be bang, there's the answer. Mirik, had you tried Llama 3 at all? It is available on a website called Grok, which is easy to get to and nice to find.
No,
it's also being hosted.
I don't think I did. I just followed the news and, you know, I'm playing with OpenAI's latest and greatest every now and then. But what's happening? Is it just faster or is it better?
That's
I remember
it.
This.
Yeah.
There were a bunch of news from Google also about their new Gemini, and I remember the previous Gemini wasn't as glamorous, right? There was some funny moments there.
Yes, it was hallucinating a little bit. I wasn't quite taken off the board, but certainly it was put up in great lights and then maybe deprecated slightly. Yeah, look, next on the list is the Gemini, and I'm glad to hear it's Gemini, not Gemini. So the old NASA. Rocket platform with multiple ways of saying it. But Google came out with that just at the same time as OpenAI, or we'll talk about Google first, it sort of makes more sense. They were also the number one thing, the most amazing thing was it was fast and multimodal. So the demos they were showing were not only text-based long queries and bang, wall of text, which was brilliant, but grabbing live camera out and actually walking around the offices looking at things, sort of doing what YOLO would do, You Only Look Once, which ironically just did a new version just yesterday, I think, called version 10, which is faster. So that's the thread of this episode. But the Gemini model was able to take live video and not just identify objects when needed, but have conversations about them, pointing to a pot plant while you're walking around an office and asking, what is it? How do I care for it? Looking at the fun one was looking at someone's computer screen at a wall of code and asking to decrypt and have a look and explain that code. And it was happening fast. Oh my God, am I going to have to pull out the phrase again? It's one of my favorite phrases to drop in a meeting and basically scare people. It's nice when you can paraphrase Stalin, I'm just going to look at your eyes now. No, okay, not scary. His quote was, quantity has a quality all of its own, talking about tanks and soldiers in World War II. But to badly paraphrase it is, does speed have a quality all of its own? Does going fast get you out of trouble so much that it can do more things than if you were doing something well but slower? Have you sort of got that kind of trip?
It's quite hard to benchmark these models, right?
It is.
And compare them with one another. So it's really not just the speed, it's what you're getting.
Yeah.
How useful it is. And I mean, you're mentioning that multimodality that Google demonstrated. Right? I think there's something different happening than YOLO. YOLO is a model that you train to recognize classes of objects. And so fundamentally, it can only recognize what you trained it on. So unless that is happening in those demos, which is possible, you could pre-train models to recognize a certain person. There's probably something else when you're able to detect from the image some more information than just bounding boxes and respond to that. I hope.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what the Gemini showed. Of at least it can do live video object identification, which is not new. It was really just the amazing thing was how panning around an office, it would just find things. Sorry, it wouldn't highlight everything because that would make your screen quite cluttered. But if you pointed it at something and asked a question in context, it kind of figured out what you were asking about and could have a serious conversation. The reason I'm asking about that bad quote about Stalin is does having the speed of reaction go from, I guess, in human interface, HCI, human interface guidelines, sort of Higgs, isn't it, go from being if something has a weight, then humans can also react and run with those pauses. But if something is instant or near instant, that crosses the gap to changing the mode of interfacing to being conversational. And hate to say, getting a little bit like the humanistic bot, chat bot that we all think they are.
Speed's definitely interesting for human interaction and getting as much as possibly done in as little time. The Gemini announcement also was about something else, right? They have this very large context window now. Yeah. I think they said million tokens or 10 million.
You
can correct me. So that's, I think, more interesting than the sheer response time. Because with large context window like that, you can remember things and you can sort of build up context on top of the training during the conversation you have with the human. And that can be much more interesting, I believe, than just pure speed. But I really can't tell the difference between those benchmarks. And there are people who are doing great work actually doing all that and comparing what they're getting from these models. I can't do that. I have other things to do.
Fair call. There's two more models to talk about. And then I do have a resource. There'll be a link in the show notes to a lovely, one of those population graphs that moves over time. But this one's to do with the chat response. So it's using ELO scores of the major models, essentially humanistic and responsiveness. So we'll tackle that as the end of trying to look at the overall comparison between models over time. But hot on the heels of Google, of course, came OpenAI's 4Omni, 4O, which of course inspired the title of this episode, Oh My, for a few reasons. The similarities were not, were quite the same as the Gemini, multimodal images, video, being able to pan around. But the real killer feature, and all the last week of news, which we may cover later on, is regard the live chat with the synthesized voices that had had ums and ahs and giggles and little bits of humanistic input to make it more than just a friend's Siri and Alexa.
And that, some sound suspiciously close to certain humans that we know, right?
We'll go straight there.
We can recognize by their voice.
Oh, yes. Sky, I must say, I was able to use it for the first few days. And my wife was able to use it while we're out and about, but it has vanished. And there is some good drama and some good back and forth over that. Let's leave Scarlett for a second, but by all means, it is a absolutely new way of working. If you can text quickly or use the microphone to do your own dictation into a text field, that's fine. That speeds things up a lot. But the OpenAI's mode of just having an ongoing open microphone conversation with your AI, that had some character, I've got to say. In actual fact, I would have loved to have seen, like we've been used to buttons on models that have a heat control. If it's hot, it's a bit noisy and hallucinating. If it's cold, it's a bit mechanical and a bit straightforward. We'd love to see a heat sort of dial on 4.0. Essentially, while it's lovely to have your AI sort of, put in those bits and bobs to make them sound human, it gets a little bit tiring after a while. And I'd almost like to take the gaps out of some of that and have an option where I'm in a hurry. I just want the answer. I don't need the icing on the cake. I just need the cake. Did you get a chance to try the chat mode of GPT-4.0?
I didn't spend much time with it, but I believe you can tone it and you could do that for a while. I remember my girlfriend having formal, like all the GPT version, draft something for her. And then it was like too pushy, too salesy. So just she just said less hyperbole, like it's as simple as that. And it produced something that was like human language, you know, not too pushy. But you can, I think you can customize the output a little bit like that already. So that should probably work with.
Okay, gotcha.
I just did synthesized voices also.
Nice. I didn't do my pre-propped engineering to say I want this voice, but I also want it terse and less of the stumbles and giggles and stuff like that.
But I believe the context window helps with that, like with that customization, because I believe what you get with like every new prompt in GPT these days on OpenAI's website is a new instance that doesn't know anything about anything else. So the customization, you can just inject the prompt right before everything, but that only gets you so far in the way of like making the model kind of more in general behave in you know, the terms of what you actually want from it and how you want to get it.
Yeah, and I've got to say that interface of live chat was pretty phenomenal. It was kind of the interface that I think people had been forecasting for a very long time. And again, with that bad quote from Stalin, it does change the game a little bit to have something that responsive and lets you stay in the flow as the human, as opposed to I am driving a cursor and I'm waiting for the screen to scroll. In this case, having a conversation with a chatbot, an agent, is enlightening. It starts a new way of working. It means that you can, on the fly, refine it. I've just been loading up a few tabs here, which might be on the show notes and in the video, for some same queries across all these four different large models that we're talking about today. And I've got to say, copying and pasting and typing was probably the hardest bit. You know, I did the same typo on 2 out of 4 prompts. So that's my fat fingers or my muscle memory not working well. If I could have just said, oi, try this, spoken out my prompt across all four models, that would have been brilliant. I think the new tools are going to be a good microphone, a good set of headphones, quiet room, and large screens. Not saying keyboard and mouse is going away, but this actually does start that conversational, extended conversational mode, which up until the moment, like now, there's always been a microphone button on almost every text input option, or every keyboard's got a microphone option so you can dictate. But this changes from dictation to conversational. And yeah, pretty wild. must say,
I mean, yeah, I see it coming. I don't think we're there quite yet. And I think there's like maybe not all sorts of work that you want to apply this to. I was just listening to this conversation, a podcast by a neuroscientist. His name is David Eagleman. And he wrote a book with his friend, who's a musician, on, you know, how all these things kind of come together. Artificial intelligence, human intelligence, how we're creative and how that happens. And so they argue, and I agree with that, that these AIs are already very creative. But what you can do, like say you're writing a piece of music, so you work on the whole piece all the time. You come back and make changes, and you know, you see the whole thing in its entirety, and you figure out like, oh, this doesn't work so well. And you do this in software also, in other areas of, you know, intellectual work. We don't work like that with AIs. We just feed it something and we expect the perfect result. But like evaluating that and coming,
yeah,
you know, making fundamental changes,
yeah,
or little changes as we go, little tweaks, is really difficult.
Yeah, it's like, and it's a one shot, you know, as opposed to a week long endeavor.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. It's this one shot kind of like, give me a good brief for a graphics designer about the logo that, yeah, you know, is for the company that,
and does you might
this
spend that, and it 5 or 10 minutes
something that's
refining
kind
it
of averaged because, yeah, of this whole data compression that it's doing.
Yeah,
but then does that. And I mean, we'll see how far we can get with these kind of systems. But it's interesting to sort of even, like, it shines light on various things that we do and don't think about that, yeah, much. And, you know, things about how we learn and how we create and what does that actually. Anyway, well, I get too philosophical.
This is almost
I see what you mean, but at, yeah, the same time, I don't think it's gonna like replace intellectual work just yet.
Gotcha. This is the machine version of the machine can't sleep on it or come back with a good idea on day 3 or 4 at this stage.
Also, the reality will be, you know, quite different than what you see in these tech demos. Like I wanted to just reiterate back to this Rabbit R1 orange, yeah, gadget that we mentioned on this podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
I was just watching this YouTube video by a pretty big channel called CoffeeZilla. We can link that in description. And he looks into that product that seems to do nothing of what it advertises. And they based all these promises of how it can do everything for you. You just talk to it and it will order your food, order your rides, handle your, you know, day-to-day mundane things. It does nothing of that. They based all this on saying they're developing this large action model, which is supposed to be this new smart thing that, yep, you know, makes you
API hooks to
makes the rabbit click, that apparently doesn't exist. And what it is in actuality is a GPT that's instructed to not tell you it is a GPT. Plus some UI scripting on various websites that order you food and do, you know, other things. And so that means that when the interface of the website changes, this whole line of functionality stops working. So this guy on YouTube tries all that was advertised in the promotional videos and none of that works. And it can't even tell his position from GPS correctly. So that's like that level of concerning.
Gotcha.
So don't spend your money on that. I think we should not advise on buying that. And it's just entertaining to watch, so we can link the video and have people decide for themselves. But even the way the company answers, reacts to the criticism is a huge red flag. They pretty much gaslight the guy and say that he's not an AI expert and they will only take criticism from AI experts and with a certificate or something like that, they say. So that's, it's very entertaining, but don't spend your money on it.
Makes sense. The rabbit has been put in the same bucket by some large reviewers as the humane pin. I've got to say, I love the concept of both of them. The humane pin, I think news of the last few days is that they're advertising that they're happy to be bought out, looking for a buyer, looking to get absorbed into one of the big four. It kind of alludes to a conversation that is about these large language models. We've had Meta, Google, OpenAI, and the last one is Microsoft, and then the hanging asterisk in the air is Apple. With those five, those are the largest companies out there by market share, by thought share. How possibly, I'm going to ask the ether, but please, if you can have a think about it, how possibly can a company that's coming in as 1/100th of the size have both a product and a software focus, hardware, software interface? It's almost no doubt that it's going to be near impossible for the small fry to break into these large markets now. The dawn of the web, 25, 30 years ago, everyone could do their own thing, and there was some amazing one-person, two-person, five-person bands did some epic work that became the big players. But now we've got to the point of the big players are sadly probably 80, 90% of the market. It's going to be almost impossible to break in.
I think there's still room for lots of creativity, and we're just discovering what these models can do. And I wouldn't underestimate the creativity of startups, but you have to put some actual work into it to create products that, you know, do something interesting. And this seems like too good to be true. You know, many of these products that will apparently magically do everything for you, it just doesn't seem like like we're there quite yet. And it seems like, the products actually overpromise and underdeliver quite often. So
no, it feels like it's a bit too easy to do epic marketing, nice PR.
I don't want to sound just negative. I started noticing language models for software packages, like I think 3.js that I'm using for something. They have documentation, and next to it is a language model. You can talk to it about the documentation and examples, and I think this is enormously useful. But it doesn't do everything for me, right? There's still work that remains to be done, and you know, things need to be in. I just talked to somebody that there's a lot work that remains to be done in integrating all these services together into products that actually make sense.
Yeah.
And it's not just the language model. There's so much to be done. And if you can, you know, sort out a different kind of area of problems or pain for the users and just combine that with this, there's a product right there. Well.
Yeah, so having a large document library like 3.js's and all the comments there is great to have that as a searchable, talkable documentation index. But that's then a silo, a pillar, which is itself smart, but it's separate from the others, surely. So there needs to be a time when either there is a standard that can interface between silos or something that can come across all of the documentation and have, topic-specific querying. So right now we probably couldn't ask any one of these large models, okay, within the bounds of just 3.js now, can I answer this question? They are general models. They've either read half the internet or the whole internet or not. They either don't know what they is behind a closed door, but you also can't say just the next 5 minutes, I just want you to focus on this code base and only answer within that sphere. They don't have that level of filtering just yet. I think they would hallucinate and get out of jail pretty quickly and start to answer things in a general sense far too fast.
Yeah, that would be fantastic to have, but I think that's fundamentally not how these models work.
Yeah.
Maybe with that, I'm really interested in what's gonna happen with this like larger context window.
Yeah.
Because I think that kind of allows you to build more of conceptual knowledge, you know, around that area or task or subject matter.
Hey. Great segue, because the fourth of the large models that was announced in the last 3-4 weeks was Microsoft with a Copilot Plus. It has an asterisk here as well, because Copilot's been around for a little bit. The two things they announced, or the two sides of the world that just collided into the middle, I'm looking down. Yes, I'm on a PC. Sorry to all my Mac friends from around the world. I now have a Copilot button in the bottom right corner of my screen, which is useful and okay. It's not fast like the others. It does have that big pregnant pause at the I'm thinking, and you can scroll faster than the output comes. But the announcement from Microsoft is that their next round of hardware/software tools are going to be Copilot plus PCs. That is, having Copilot more directly tied into the operating system experience. With the first bullet that everyone just sort of opened their eyes at and had a bit of a half a fit about is that it's able to almost always record your screen to have that context window of what you're doing and what you're working on. So that if you were able to type or grab the microphone out and say, hey, I'm having problems with what I'm doing now, we already know what you're doing with context, both context window and context in the language sense, and be able to assist you with what you're working on. So, hey, I'm having problems with this document. Can you reach in and help me? And it already has knowledge based on not screen scraping, but direct connection to GPU and the draw of the screen to know what that is. That makes sense in that regard. Rather than doing a bolt-on over the top of pointing a video camera at your screen, makes sense to go right to the ones and zeros before they became pixels and have that knowledge. But that, Copilot plus PC has been pretty both welcomed and divisive. And I think everyone with a privacy bent has just taken a double take or a triple take. It's been quite an astounding revelation that that's probably something which we're going to be well used to in 2 years. But I think announcing it right now is definitely a few people pretty hard. Thoughts on that? If an app was able to natively operating system assist you with your tasks, whatever that was, without having to interpret pixels, but know before you even draw it on screen.
Yeah, it definitely makes sense technically to integrate something like that as close to the metal as possible, right? But this, I agree with those, with the concerns that you're raising, because there's, yes, it's,
yeah,
it's a big brother that you're letting into your computer and
yeah,
giving it all the keys. And yes, I mean,
yeah, it's not almost certainly with the way that these large language models are working. It's not using your pixels to train on. It's been trained. It's just using it to interpret that request at that second. But at some point in time, it's going to assimilate your culture into our own, as the Borg would say.
There will be concerns. At the same time, Microsoft is really going all in on,
yep,
on AI,
yep,
on all fronts. And I can't even mention all the names of the companies they invested in, but it's not just OpenAI. They're,
yep,
they're even investing into OpenAI's competition and just covering as,
yep,
as much of the market as possible.
Yeah.
And that tight integration with user products is, I believe, where the value is.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, it's kind of concerning and interesting to watch, and kind of like you want the computers to be smarter and faster and do everything for you, but at the same time,
you don't want them to know what you have for breakfast exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, look, your segues are working really well. I don't know whether you knew we're going to be heading here, but of the four models talked about, again, Facebook's Llama 3, Google's Gemini, OpenAI's 4 Omni or Omni, Microsoft going in. The gorilla in the room, the elephant in the corner is Apple, is, the pundits say lagging behind, but their WWDC is happening in the next couple of weeks, and I would probably bet the farm that they're going to, well, let me put it this way, Apple is the only company who has both the hardware and software stack completely under their control. Every Apple phone and Apple device in the last, well, the M series has just as many TPUs, basically AI neural chips, as they do graphics or CPU chips. There's a lot that happens when you take a photo on your iPhone that is more AI than anything. If it's a picture of the sky, it'll probably make it a bit clearer and a bit bluer. If it's someone's face, they'll probably try and figure out that let's not make them look like they were, you know, pale and about to keel over. There's a lot of computing resources tied directly to an operating system in that whole platform. And they have announced, well, ChatGPT, also at the same time that they announced for Omni, also put out a first native asterisk-ish app for Mac OS. Kind of neat, kind of weird that that was the case. You can access it quite perfectly fine on browser or device relatively natively. To have it as a first-party application is a sign. Yeah, I'd say I'd bet the farm that in the next month at the worldwide Apple conference that we'll probably have some tighter AI integration everywhere. Let's face it, Siri has... Devices didn't go on. Excellent.
Siri has been able to set my timer perfectly, almost perfectly.
Siri
for
was
years now.
Siri,
so
yep.
We're thrilled to see what's next.
There it goes. One, two, three devices just woke up. It's okay, Siri.
But
you
yeah,
can
that,
stay.
That's pretty much all I was ever able to use Siri for. So
yeah.
if they just make this work as they advertised years ago, that would be fantastic.
Well. That actually is probably one of the fundamental human interface sort of hassles of the last, when has Siri been out? I'd almost say 7 years Siri's been around. The problem with an interfaceless interface is that for all of us mere mortals who are used to screens full of icons, if we don't recall the keyboard combination or we can't recall what the icon looks like, hunting the menus is a thing. And within a half a second, you've found what you're looking for. It's not too hard. It's there somewhere is normally the answer when you have a rich interface. When you have an interfaceless interface, it's very binary. Either it does a brilliant job and you love it, or it sucks. The early days of Siri were leaning more to the second than the first. Of if you would ask it, you know, how do I get from A to B? Or if you ask it a question that literally can't answer, I think in the beginning, it couldn't even go out to the web and find a half-assed answer for you. It would simply, I can't answer that. You could do things like control your timer, set alarms, integration with maps, but a few core phone apps, nothing more. In the last few years, though, and this is the peril of an interfaceless interface, and a lesson now for ChatGPT for Omni with this chat interface, that balance between an AI hallucinating and telling me why the sky is purple in convincing 12,000 page essay, great, but you're wrong, versus Siri and other agents being helpful and being able to solve more problems than solve just the right number of problems and then quietly give up when really they shouldn't answer a common query. Have you used Siri for more stuff in recent times or more the point?
Oh, I would love to, but it simply didn't work ever. And I don't think it's just my funky accent. It's just like that for everybody. So timer or wake-up alarm
good.
That I barely use, and that's it. Like, you know, you can't ask it what song is playing when you're driving because it just pops out Google search.
My number one use of Siri, I must say, is around the family dinner table when someone in my family says, oh, yeah, I must remember to do that, and invariably forget, maybe. You know, we sort of go, grab your phone. Hey, doofus, remind me tomorrow to do the thing. And more often than not, that's perfect. That is an example of the human being kind of trained to use keywords, get the order vaguely right, and, you know,
yeah, but if
do
it's,
commands.
You know, like, at the same time, the human is trained to not trust Siri because it just doesn't do anything else well. So I can't rely on the fact that it's going to put anything in my calendar if I just tell it and don't check on it.
Yep.
And if I go and check if it's really there, like, I could have done it.
You could done yourself, yeah.
So it's really like you figure out what kind of tasks you can use it for, and then you use it just for that because you know that nothing else works. And
that's it.
It's really hard to convince you that, oh, we updated it and now it's fine. It can do like all these other things.
That's it. There is no manual for it. And if they do 5 years later release a slew of features or a slew of API, you know, to check the baseball scores in your region, unless you are made aware of that, if you try twice to ask that question and you get stupid answers, you will not try a third time. And even if they tell you later on that feature has been put in, chance of you using it's low. So that is the classic example of building up trust over a period of years with an interfaceless, no button, no icon interface that you either trust or you use for small things. My question to you is comparing that to OpenAI's chat interface with audio with, yes, not Scarlett Johansson, but Sky and the four other voices now. That one's been removed. what would you prefer? Would you prefer something that is conversational and ironically might make stuff up over time? Or would you prefer something that's a bit more mechanical and concrete, but you have to learn how to trust it and how to use certain features? Where's your level of preference there?
I think it really depends on what you're doing, right? First, it's a personal preference, but then sometimes you want the hallucination. Sometimes you want some inspiration for something creative. And I think that's what this works really well for, although, you know, it's not the most creative. It's kind of like mediocre creative.
Oh, gee. Wow. You're in trouble.
But it's there. And so the one task is to do that. The other is, you know, yes, no answer to something. And I don't want to read five paragraphs of fluff to that. Yes, no, it would be fine. But it really depends on the situation, I guess.
I'll put forward two scenarios that our family has used ChatGPT for in the last couple of weeks that have been good use cases that we wouldn't have thought. My daughter's doing university, astrophysics. So not exactly rocket science, but the next thing over. She was having to do an essay on a really deep, gnarly topic. All good. She couldn't get started because the one phrase that she had in her mind of the topic that she was trying to do was the wrong phrase. It was the one that she had in her mind of what she was trying to focus on. And guess what? There were no references in scientific papers for it. It was just the wrong word. And Google could not help when she searched for that phrase. She found millions of answers, but none with that context. Well, guess what? ChatGPT was able to assist by basically being the world's biggest thesaurus for synonyms, basically putting in that key phrase saying, if I've got this term, what else should I be looking for? And bang, it came out with, you know, a long word list bullet points of, if you meant this, here's other topics that are highly related to it. And suddenly that opened the door to her to, I had my facts wrong, my keywords wrong, now the doors are open and I can find everything I need to research my essay. That was really good because all other online tools were just being quite mechanical in that search phrase equals this, but no creativity and little context apart from if you meant this, did you mean this? So that was a win. The other one was showing my wife, ChatGPT 4.0 and having a conversation about geology. Now, with ChatGPT 3 and 4 plain, you could have GPTs, basically other GPT instances that people had made where they'd done the pre-prompt engineering to say, you're a geologist, answer this in a, you know, in either a layperson's terms or a professor, like a, you know, of a certain educational level to make it work. But they're basically pre-faced. Most questions need to be answered with this context in mind. Those were okay, not exactly awesome. They were fair, but they didn't really have a free range of options. They basically said, here's five texts or five corpuses, use that as your foundation. 4.0 was able to have a conversation with my wife about not only the ground underneath which you were standing, but, and here's the spatial part of it, if I'm traveling from A to B, what shall I be looking for while I'm on this route? And it did a pretty bang-up job to actually say, well, as you transfer from A through B, make sure you're watching out for this kind of feature in this first half. And if you look across here, you'll find, it didn't say left or right. It didn't know which way she was facing. But it had that context both of topic, an arcane topic, like a deep topic. But it also had that in terms of relevance of place. And that was quite phenomenal. Now, we were tourists at that point in time. We didn't have our encyclopedia or our geologist's handbook to Estonia and Finland. There you go, some name dropping for you where it was last week. So we couldn't fact check it. But tell you what, we turned over every rock that we saw and my wife was able to validate most of what she was talking through. So pretty phenomenal. Obviously, this is a tool that has read the internet. We all kind of know that. So the body of knowledge is huge, but to have a deep, dark conversation on a pretty specific topic with spatially aware, I'm here, I'm going to there, tell me everything I need to know as I travel. I must say, we were reasonably flawed. And then to have it icing on the cake, here we go, to have that in the Scarlett Johansson voice, oh my God, that was absolutely, it was a delight to see and to hear, but it was definitely, definitely got a little bit freaky. The controversy there has only escalated in the last few days. Apparently, which is not rocket science now, apparently OpenAI did not use her voice. They did hire an unnamed actress who is still remaining unnamed. That's all fine. But without fail, eerily similar. And I think everybody in the world kind of thinks that voice number one sounds a lot like a person. Well, it doesn't matter if it's not. It's meant to be replicating that person.
We're headed for some weird times. It's only going to get funnier.
Yeah, yeah.
And weirder.
It is. It is. I know the Siri lady, I believe, is from Australia and has been having an awesome time in the last many years extending her vocal repertoire to in-person events and the rest of it. I believe she spent a couple of many, many sessions talking all sorts of things. It wasn't with Apple at that point. It was with a third party who she was hired to be the voice of. Obviously, it went further. I dare say she's been paid quite well, but that voice of is certainly pretty infamous now. I must say, what voice do you use on your devices or your Apple devices? Do you use the default Siri? By that, I'm meaning female voice, or do you use...
I think I do. I think I use the British Siri.
Ah, nice. Nice. I didn't realize it was such a regional thing, but it does have a psychology to it of, do you want your assistant to be, something that you're used to, something that you're not used to? It almost defines whether, it's probably the same with interfaceless. It's almost hard to figure out what other voices there are. Once you start with one, I dare say if they add new features of voice 9, 10, and 11, you probably won't ever realize that. So for me, it's just the default and still sits well. I dare say OpenAI's Sky won't make a comeback anytime soon. I know I might get fried for this, but I really can't handle Southern USA. For me, that involves a little bit, for me, too much mental thinking. I've got to really, listen carefully. It'd be like if I had someone as my chat AI who was quoting Shakespeare, like a really high Shakespeare voice. Love it in context, great, but takes a few too many brain cells to pass what was said before I can, fluidly do it. It takes me out of my zone a little bit. You're currently out of Vancouver. A nice Canadian voice might go down well. How are you fitting in amongst the natives?
Oh, yeah. All is good.
Oh, yeah.
All is good.
Yeah. Hoot in the boot. Sorry, everyone. We're just, basically going to lose half our viewership in most nations now. The context for, I think, how you want your AI assistant is going to be a great conversation for the rest of this year. I wonder soon if you can input your own voices. We know there's many services on the internet where you can grab small snippets of text and have that turned into a speech model. I wonder if you can basically, after a while, reference or upload a few minutes or someone talking and then use that as your own fodder. That may get around some of the legal things if you can install your own voices locally. I think a David Attenborough / chat would be a little bit, again, it's got to be something that's generic enough to not take you out of the moment.
Wild. I would use David Attenborough every day.
Explain my code to me. Oh, of course, the African savannah. I dare say there's a lot of famous people who are worried that their voice likeness is going to be hot on the chopping board. Yeah. I guess fraction more serious. what can you see that these fast language models are going to change your workflow? I know you're deep in code, you're interfacing, you're doing gnarly problems. I have to say, are your fingers and mouse literally the tools of choice forever, or can you see a transition to talking through some of the blocks that you're doing?
I see myself using anything that helps, but at the same time, a lot of what I do is integrating complicated things together. And it kind of helps to understand those individual bits. It's kind of like outsourcing your work to individual engineers who do just exactly what you tell them, right? And that sometimes is not what you want. It works in teams because people have initiative, and you know, you have, if you can afford to have expert for each individual thing that you're dealing with or somebody to learn it, then you expect that initiative and not just, you know, to follow through what you tell them blindly. So I use AI where it helps to sort of make sense of this or that, but then I sort of need to be able to understand all these elements, and that's kind of the job. That's, you know, that's what you do to make a product or put things together in order to make something useful. So I'm open to have something write a piece of boring code for me every time. I don't enjoy boilerplates and, you know, starting from scratch and like reinventing the wheel. So all for that, but you know, I just like can't outsource my thinking to a machine.
Completely,
and I don't want to.
So no, that makes perfect sense.
It's like it's definitely getting useful, and I'm following it very, very with open mind.
Yeah, look, you are a classic example of being at the pointy end. You are you are doing something which is seriously bespoke. I dare say there's no one else in the world doing exactly what you're doing. So,
I think you could say that about many things.
Yep.
You know, but if you have a GPT write book for you, then who did the writing and where the value is, and is this any interesting read in the first place? Right.
You came up in a conversation also during the week. Don't panic. I saw a meme that made me think of you. It's all right, you weren't in the meme. But one summary of generative AI, large language models or multimodal models, hit home a little bit. It was a meme on LinkedIn, so apologies. It only had two panels, same text twice. The text was, I would much rather my AI did my washing and my cooking for me rather than my painting and my writing. You know, versus right now, it does my creative arts and it does do the damn physical thing.
Interestingly enough, that's where we started, right? And all the people who do the drawing and writing and, you know, storytelling are concerned and see these technologies quite differently than the tech people.
Yeah.
Which is very interesting to watch. And to many people, there's this class A lawsuit with Sarah Silverman, I believe, being part of it, or was that settled? So that was a really quick and kind of awakening for me, because there's a whole bunch of other people who see this as just stolen data and scraped examples of other people's work, and you know, gets you philosophical about how do we learn, what's original, what's creative. And I don't think it's quite different than how people learn. I would say that it's not just, you know, faking it.
Yep.
But it produces this blend of whatever you feed it or a replica of that. And it's just, that's not good or bad. It's just what it is, I think.
Well, the reason why you're in that meme, of course, was to basically say, if you could please hurry up and finish your operating system for robots so that we can control them and have them around our house, that would be fantastic.
I'm on it, yes.
Okay. So more coffee is required. More energy drinks are required.
That for sure.
Look, last thoughts. I'll leave in the show notes. I'll quickly share screen, which is probably easiest anyway. Share that one. Look, yep. This is a classic chart in the style of population GDP over time. This one has the top ranked large language and multimodal models by company based on the scores from Chatbot Arena. So basically how responsive, how lifelike were they? It's only the last year and doesn't sort of start you know, at zero. It sort of starts with a little bit, but I think the chart's about to finish. Yeah, there we go. It's basically showing some major jumps. I guess the headline is OpenAI has basically been the leader for almost all but like a couple of weeks. Anthropic came in there for a little while early in March, it says. Google just made a massive jump with Gemini, and Meta a few weeks ago with Llama. So look, with that fail, all those charts are going up. All the major competitors for large language models are becoming more conversational, becoming more convincing. It is, as you say, hard to measure these things. On our own website, spatial.space, we've got the continuing charts of life architects ratings of how efficient is a large model, basically its parameters to its output. The one that's conspicuously missing is OpenAI's for Omni. We don't have a lot of data on that, so there's probably a big dot to go on that screen later on. It is near impossible now to assess these from any mechanical point of view. It is almost a guaranteed. It has to be felt, not tested. I know I've scared half of my colleagues over the last 5 years by saying that you can't test AI. I work in a field.
I think it should be tested at the same time.
I know. But I work in a field where testing is a large portion of everything. And, you know, being able to sign off on something and say it hits all your requirements perfectly and passed every test is important. These are tools that you can test forever, but you can't ever sign off and say that 100% perfect, everything was hit, there were no misses, you know, we've gotten every last niggle worked out of these things. These are, everyone can break them. In fact, it seems to be a worldwide sport the moment a new model comes out. How can I quickly show how it's doing a stupid thing as fast as possible, as opposed to using it for good? So yeah, testing is a process, but it's not a exhaustive process anymore. It hit the marks well against our known benchmarks, but it read the entire internet. We can't ask it enough questions to prove that it did. I'd love to know whether you are going to be using more large language models for coding more. Is there a go-to for you, and are you always able to just grab onto the next thing, or are you basically tied in your IDE, your code environment, to one assistant type?
I don't know yet. I'm definitely thinking about what I can do with these models. And in the last episode, I spoke about Ross, and I think I didn't do it a good service. That sounds like another depressed engineer, I think. To keep it on the bright side,
okay.
There's a lot of data that you get in standardized form and shape. And if you then somehow vectorize that and feed it into a model and train it to do something that you want, that's exactly how you do that.
Yeah, nice.
But you think about, I think, distinct tasks that robots perform and not, general intelligence. At most of the times, you think about a problem that you want the robot to solve, because that, in my mind, defines what physical capabilities it needs to have and what kind of, intelligence it needs to come with. So you don't need your Roomba to talk back to you about Shakespeare, right? It's not necessary.
Yeah.
So you use these tools where you can, and there's only so much you can actually calculate on the edge unless you use expensive hardware. Like, one might say NVIDIA enables you to do just that, but it comes at a cost.
Yeah.
Maybe you don't need to do all of that. Maybe you can do it somewhere else. Maybe, it really depends on the use case. So definitely I will at some point when I get to it, but most of my work is just integrating things together and seeing where it takes me and, using whatever is there to make it faster and more useful.
Yeah, nice. Look, I've got the luxury of not having a single project to focus on, so I get to really scatter brain and try out most of the leading lights. I must say, here in my open tabs, I'm paying for OpenAI. I haven't forked up for Google. and Meta and others are sort of open and free. I'm actually interested, and we may tackle in a future episode what we can do locally as opposed to using these large models. So basically the opposite of today's topic of, yes, these are the leading lights, cloud-based, huge. I'm actually coming down to what can we use that's a decimated teacher-student local model that can still do good for us. That may be a great topic to find out what is faster, and we can actually train on our own data. Something that really is the opposite of what we're talking about here. Hopefully still fast, but likely a fraction slower.
Well, but things like you spoke about voice synthesis, right? That's a thing to do locally, I guess, to get around those lags, because you send something as text and then you synthesize it in, you know, human speech pace.
Yep.
So that's definitely something that like helps you to speed up response times. In robotics, you want to do certain computer vision tasks as fast as possible to avoid, you know, dangerous situations. But there's like higher level of obstruction that you might do slower than that, maybe. Okay. And few seconds of like a fine.
Mm.
So it really comes down to what you're doing and how fast you really need the result, or if doing something locally makes your experience much, much better. Say, if you're waiting for a voice to be synthesized in the cloud, there's going to be a significant
big lag. Yeah.
I mean, you're streaming in the real time, almost real time, but
yep.
Maybe it makes sense to send text and synthesize locally. Maybe it doesn't, you know, it comes down to...
This is the AI version of Internet of Things, edge processing, which, of course, you're using with your the robotics world big time. So you're saying that vision needs to be closer to the robot so that it can avoid the thing quickly, yet there can be slower commands that you can send back to a larger brain to do some meta tasks.
But even with vision, it might be just some of the tasks, you know, just the time critical things, like I don't want to bump into anything as I'm driving my robot around real fast, right?
Mm.
So that obstacle avoidance must be as fast as possible, and most likely you want it to work even when the connection goes down. So
yeah,
I mean the robot should stop and all that, but
yeah,
you might want to have some level of autonomy on the edge.
That high level functions, come with route like planning,
the whole package.
Yeah. Look, interesting parallel there between the world of large language models and robotics. I think that's one of the things that we'll draw between last episode and this one, the fact that it's an ecosystem. These aren't simply one-trick ponies that you either use or love. And even sadly, the pace of change is going to get larger from here. We might leave it there, but I'll tell you what, this topic hasn't stopped at all. As I say, the elephant in the room, elephant in the corner, anyway, mixing metaphors horribly, Apple is yet to release what they're doing in this sphere. So we may well come back in 2 months with precis of what they've been up to or what they're planning. In their typical fashion, they'll probably pre-announce what they're going to do, but then not actually will put that out till later in the year. That's the normal way. They don't have the same competitive urgency as some of their other large players. So they may talk about it for a while and give us a chance to get used to the idea before software gets rolled into our devices close to hand. Mirek, thanks for that. I know this is an exciting time with another epoch. I think we almost draw a line in the sand pretty much of April and May 2024. This is the time when our AIs, our language models, our multimodal models started to go from being query response to, oh my God, I'm having a serious conversation. I don't think we're going to go back from this date at all. I think this is going to be the way going forward. We're probably not going to tolerate blinking cursors and I'm thinking. We're going to have conversations and be able to iterate and just refine our ideas on the fly. As I say, I dare say the tools of the future are going to be a good microphone and a glass of water next to us if we're going to be talking a hell of a lot. Well, if that's the case for microphones and glasses of water, we're in the right spot. Thanks for that. We'll catch you next week. We'll be back on a regular schedule. I'm back in country. We've got a series of interviews lined up, actually, starting from here, which is brilliant. We'll reveal all as we go. As always, show notes. This one's available on audio format everywhere. Video, do check out on YouTube. We can wave. You can see Turtle. You can see my cats. Your background, yeah, less robots. You need to up your game. That's all right. We want them everywhere. Bonus points if you can have them running around in the room behind you while you're talking. I guess that's a bit noisy. Alrighty, that's a challenge for next time. From us here, we'll say catch you next time, and thanks for listening on Spatial. But for now, bye-bye.
Bye.
If you'd like more news and insights about Spatial AI, or have a story or interesting topic you'd like us to cover, reach out to us. Better yet, come and join the community at Spatial. All the links are in the show notes. We'll be right back.